And welcome to the Healing of Agape this week. Today's guest is Dr. Russell Targ, who I consider the world's expert on remote viewing. How are you, Dr. Targ?
I'm very happy to be with you this evening.
Well, thanks for coming on tonight. So tell us just a little bit about you before we get started, where people can find you. You've got a new book out, The End of Suffering, A Guide to Fearless Living.
Well, I'm a physicist, and I worked at Lockheed for many years putting lasers on airplanes. I had about 20 years in laser development, research, and applications. And then a mid-course correction where I was working for more than a decade at Stanford Research Institute in Palo Alto, California, where I was co-founder of a program called Remote Viewing, where we would teach people how to get in touch with the part of themselves that's psychic. And we did that ESP research for a decade, teaching government scientists and Army intelligence people how to do psychic spying during the Cold War.
And this was hard science that you were doing with these people. I mean, you were having actual good results, weren't you?
We were having very good results. There were two aspects to the program. One of them was the part where we were really the X-Files. Day after day, we were providing the government with information about Soviet weapon sites or Chinese bomb tests or missing Russian airplanes, and we can talk about that later on. So we had a definite application side that was top secret and that I could only talk about starting in 1995 when I got the program declassified from Freedom of Information.
You had to go through some work to do that, didn't you?
I certainly did. I had a threat to sue the CIA to get the program declassified and the material released to me. And they had a choice of either releasing the material or, probably more interesting, to go to court to show why this ESP program was vital to national security and they couldn't talk about it. So they thought that it would be less wear and tear on the CIA to simply release the material to me and allow me to describe it to you.
Why did they not want to do this?
Well, they supported us very well for 25 years during the Cold War, and then where we were providing a lot of information for them, and we helped set up a ESP activity for Army intelligence at Fort Meade in Virginia. They had a parallel program so that they just didn't have to deal with psychics in California, which made them nervous.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted their own men in green fatigues learning to be psychics, and we did that quite successfully. But by 1995, the Cold War was over, of course, and the CIA decided that America no longer had any dangerous enemies, so they could disband this program and save money.
I have a question here. I know that you're familiar with the work that's going on in consciousness right now, you know, spiritual enlightenment, spiritual epiphanies and stuff. Does it make any difference the level of spiritual awareness someone has to the ability to remote view, or can just anybody across the board do it?
Anybody across the board can do it to a greater or lesser degree. It often goes in the other direction from what you're suggesting. That is to say, people who become very good at remote viewing catch on to the fact that they could not possibly be just a physical body, because when they quiet their mind, their awareness is able to move out and fill all of space and time.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes totally obvious to an experienced remote viewer that he couldn't be just a physical body, because his awareness and his consciousness is not at all limited to his physical body. And that was really the path that I took.
Mm-hmm.
That is, my spiritual development was entirely funded by the CIA, where they supported me to sit in the dark with my eyes shut for a decade, helping people learn to be psychic.
You don't have very good vision either, so it's not something that's done with your eyes, right?
No, it's not done with your eyes. The remote viewing is a kind of experiencing things that happen in the distance or in the future. And what we learned is it is no more difficult to describe something across the planet than it is to describe something across the street. Similarly, it's no harder to describe something that I will show you tomorrow than it is for you to describe the object that I'm holding in my hand right now. That's why we call it a non-local ability. Non-locality is an exciting part of modern physics, where even modern physicists recognize that there are many cases where things appear to be separate from one another, but they're actually entangled and connected together, and that especially pertains to our consciousness.
Well, now that you've brought up that word consciousness, what is your definition of consciousness? I've been doing a segment where I've been interviewing Dean Radden, Brenda John, Bill Tiller, Amit Goswami, a bunch of people. And one of the questions I've been asking them is, what is your definition of consciousness? And I was surprised to find out, when I ask 30 different people, what is your definition, I get 30 different answers.
Well, as far as, I'm really an unreconstructed physicist, so I describe things in terms of experience. So for me, consciousness is my awareness of myself together with my non-local awareness. So consciousness really is awareness for me.
And
one of the things that I'm aware of is the universe is filled with consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to remote viewing, which is a kind of clairvoyant perception. I mean, all of this was understood for thousands of years. The idea of clairvoyance is that you quiet your mind and you can describe and experience simply what it looks like in a distant place.
Now, how do you get this information? Do you get it in pictures? Do you get it in words? How does it come through to you? How do you discern it?
In general, people get it in pictures to start with. What I tell people to do is quiet your mind. We're going to show you something in a little while. Tell me what you see on your mental screen. As you quiet your mind with your eyes shut, tell me about the surprising images that appear in your awareness.
And do you give some instruction that they're something they're looking for? Or do you just...
Well,
how do you start off?
Let's say I was asking you to describe an object that I have on my desk, which we don't have to do on the air if you don't want to. I would say I'm holding an unusual object, and I want you to describe the shapes or forms or color that comes to view. Don't try and guess it, what it is. Don't name it. Don't grasp it. Just describe the surprising shapes that appear in your awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So I would lead you in a visual exercise to describe the surprising things that appear in awareness. Now, by and by, I would say, well, your description is very nice. I think you've made contact with my object. Now, imagine that you're holding it in your hand. Turn it over. What else appears to view? What does it feel like as you try and squeeze it? How much weight do you experience as you try and heft it or throw it in the air? So we start with visual experiences, but I can lead you into all sorts of tactile experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you asked me at the outset for my contact information, which I didn't give you. If people want to reach me, they can just, my email is espresearch.com.
E as in ever, S as in Sam, and T as in Paul.
Like, just like extrasensory perception.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Espresearch.com.
And your new book, is that on that site too?
Yes, my new
book.
You've
got several books out, don't you?
Yeah, my new book is called The End of Suffering.
And how did you jump from research into conscious suffering?
Well, that came to me after I left SRI. At SRI, I had half of the picture. At SRI, it became clear to me that I couldn't just be a physical body, that it was a mistake to think that who I am is what it says on my business card, and I began to pursue a spiritual path. in my case, I began to get interested in A Course in Miracles.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have a dark night of the soul? A lot of the people that I've interviewed have all started out by having something bad happen. And it made them kind of wake up that there was something.
Well, the turning point for me in 92, I had left SRI and written a couple of books and joined Lockheed. And then 1992, it appeared that I had a recurrence of cancer that I had had at an earlier time. And they thought I was going to die. In fact, it's the old, put your affairs in order. I don't think we're going to help you. It looks like you have a metastasis from an earlier cancer that you had. And just by the way, I'm just fine. My cancer surgery was 25 years ago, and I'm doing fine. But by 92, they thought I was very sick. And at that point, I started to do things that to change my life. Mm-hmm. One of them was get involved in a spiritual group involving Course in Miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I observed as I was working at Lockheed, which is a 200,000-person engineering organization, as you may realize, I noticed each week that they would publish their newspaper that there were an awful lot of pretty young engineers dying. In fact, they had a section called In Memoriam, which is very important to the story, because I would see that people would retire at 65, which is mandatory retirement, after 25 or 30 years with Lockheed, and within a couple of years they die. And I, being a good statistician, I went down to the newspaper office and got 100 past issues for 100 weeks of the magazine and figured out what is the expected life longevity of a person who retired from Lockheed. And it was 2 or 3 years.
Really?
Rather than the 15 years you'd expect.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time a man has gotten to be 65 years old, he's past the danger of being shot by his friend while hunting, or crashing motorcycles, or dying in the war. Men have passed all the crazy things that kill them off in earlier life, so that from actuarial tables, an ordinary guy who lives to be 65 has another 15 years. For some reason, these Lockheed engineers were dying within 2 years. In fact, one of my good friends who is head of marketing said, I'm going to retire. No, I'm going to retire a little early. I want to have plenty of money. I want to smell the roses. And within a week of retirement, he had died of a heart attack.
Really?
And I then started doing a little research, and I talked to my friends at Boeing. I did that recently in conjunction with writing The End of Suffering. And Boeing also had huge numbers of premature deaths from retiring engineers. So much so that Boeing was considering underfunding their pension plan because nobody was living long enough to collect it.
That's amazing. Now, were they dying of miscellaneous things, or were there particular kinds?
They're dying of miscellaneous things. They're dying of the stress from losing their business card.
Mm-hmm.
See, if you work as an Army officer or an aerospace engineer, you're very proud of what you're doing. It's a sense of accomplishment. You have a business card that says, I'm a Lockheed engineer, or I'm an Army colonel, and that's who I am, and that's what I've been for many, many years. And you're very in love with your business card. And then when you get to be 65, the company tears up your business card, sends you out the door, and suddenly you're nothing. They send you home to annoy your wife. And there's no longer anything in the in-basket, and these people die.
It takes away who you are, basically, if you're not prepared.
So the message of my book, The End of Suffering, is that it's critically important that you discover who you are before they take away your business card, and not to spend your life defending your story. is the defending your story that causes suffering.
Now, you had a tragedy in your life with your daughter. How does this help you with that? And that would kill anybody.
Well, I would say that I certainly did have a tragedy. And the end of suffering that I'm dealing with is, in the case of the book, I'm dealing with really self-inflicted suffering. Now, there is genuine suffering that occurs in the world, which is not self-inflicted. If a person is dying of cancer, or has lost a loved one, or has intractable poverty for some reason, or is presently in a concentration camp, they have a kind of existential suffering imposed on them by some easy-to-describe outside source.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a hospital and you're dying and you're in pain. I would honor that suffering, obviously. Or if your boyfriend or girlfriend has left you, you've been in love, and then they decided they just don't want to be with you anymore, and they walk out.
Mm-hmm.
That can cause a lot of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
That you're really not inflicting on yourself. You've experienced a loss. Similarly, when my daughter Elizabeth died 4 years ago at the peak of her medical career, doing wonderful research demonstrating the efficacy of prayer and sort of carrying on the work that I had been doing, losing her was a horrible experience for me, and it's really her untimely death at 40 that pushed me in the direction of writing this book. But that's not really the kind of suffering that I'm talking about. If you have a
talking about like personal depression, that there's no thing really going on in your life I'll give you an example. For example, in my life, my husband, we almost got divorced, and now he's profoundly depressed, even though everybody got back together, because he can't get out of the past. Is that what you mean?
That's right. In that case, he has to get in touch with the spiritual aspect of himself. There's one of the critical things that a person has to do is realize that in a certain sense, nothing at all is happening. The Buddhists say that the universe is empty of meaning apart from the meaning you give it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people always get very annoyed with the Buddhists when they say emptiness is the most important teaching, because a person says, well, I see a glass of water and a clock in front of me. What do you mean the world is empty? And the teaching is there are indeed things in the physical universe, but you give them all the meaning they have for you. They don't come with any meaning. I have a painting on my wall which I think is very beautiful. Somebody else could come along and say, that's a stupid painting. Why would you have that in your office?
So it's merely a perspective.
That's right.
How would you help
And we have a lot of suffering defending our view of reality.
How do you help someone get beyond that doesn't believe that it's real?
Well, in my book, as you know, the Buddhists have an eightfold way. There's eight steps to deal with suffering. And I've compressed those into five, sort of in ordinary California English.
Mm-hmm.
One is mindfulness, which is the transcendent knowing that who you are is the spaciousness. That is, who you are is the flow of loving awareness. That is, it never works out to try and find a partner who will solve all your problems for you. As Mark Ammon had a song a few years ago called Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places, which you may remember.
Mm-hmm.
And the teaching of mindfulness is to recognize that who you are is this flow of loving awareness. When you quiet your mind, you can experience your own loving nature, a kind of oceanic connection with nature. And that can be a religious experience or a spiritual experience, but you don't have to be a religious person to experience that love.
So would the point be, you know, a lot of people say, think about what you've gone through and talk about it. Would the point be to stop thinking about it, be in the moment?
Definitely, to move into the present time.
Not what was 5 minutes or what might be, but what exactly what you're doing.
That's right. Only the present exists for you now. You can't mend or change the past. But when you quiet your ongoing chatter, some kind of meditation practice gives you the tools to do that, to move into the spaciousness, and then you can participate in the transcendent knowing, which is the kind of remote viewing we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
where you transcendent knowing, where you're able to look into the distance and look into the future, and the transcendent doing, where you can use your intuitive or psychic abilities to heal the sick or reduce their suffering, and the transcendent being, which allows you to move from your ego nature. Your ego nature, of course, is self-centered and self-pitying and lonely, and you can move from your ego nature to your spacious nature, where you're flexible and generous and joyful and loving. And you can move from the ego to spaciousness in an instant. There's a great Buddhist teacher called Padmasambhava from the 8th century who understood this perfectly. And he talked about moving from conditioned awareness, where we try and name and grasp things, and we're imprisoned by what we've been taught by the church and our parents.
Mm-hmm.
You can move from conditioned awareness to spaciousness and naked existence, where you experience things as they are, free of conditioning. And that's what I do in a remote viewing workshop, where I teach people to experience things directly without naming them.
And it's not something that takes a period of time. You can do it literally in an instant.
That's right. Moving from conditioned awareness to naked awareness is a change of your mind, but you have to stop the chattering in order to do that. You have to get control of your mind through some kind of meditation where you can actually sit quietly. You don't have to eat porridge at the feet of your guru. That is not necessary, but you have to. There are countless people who will teach you how to meditate.
Go ahead.
Jack Kornfield has books on meditation. He's an experienced Vipassana teacher. I spent 10 days with him in silence, and that was very rewarding for me. So we've talked about mindfulness and emptiness. The next thing you want to be aware of is compassion, where the spaciousness you experience is generous and loving, and you have, once you have experienced your own divine nature, your own spacious, loving nature, what gives meaning to your life is to then help other people to have that experience.
Now, I have a question here. I personally agree with you that a lot of the enlightened teachers say there's no thing to fix. In fact, my teacher constantly says that to me. There's no thing to fix. You don't need to go out and do anything for anybody. But I'm of the opinion that if we do live in a holographic experience, we can make this roller coaster ride a fun one, or we can make it be a haunted house. So why do spiritual teachers not always promote compassion for other people when it does do something?
Every spiritual teacher that I've been involved with has compassion as the top priority after you've gotten control of your own crazy mind.
Mm-hmm.
Once you stop the monkey chatter in your own head, the thing that gives meaning to your mind is to interact with the rest of the world through compassion, because the world is full of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And what could give meaning to your life more than helping reduce the suffering that's in the world?
So let's talk about the science of that for a minute.
So certainly, throughout the Buddhist and Christian teachings, helping people reduce suffering, helping reduce the suffering in the world, is something that we can do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a metaphysical principle. By recognizing that there is only one of us here in consciousness,
mm-hmm.
that there are many bodies, one consciousness, by recognizing your oneness with the tired checkout girl of the supermarket or the angry gas station attendant or whoever you run into who's had a hard day, recognizing that there's no separation between you and them is a big step toward reducing the suffering in the world. And why would you not want to do that?
Would you agree that when you are kind to someone, that something happens to that person? If they will accept it, their heart rate changes, you know, their skin temperature changes. It actually does something when you practice that, doesn't it?
Oh, when you're kind to another person, something happens to you as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's this outflow of your loving intention, healing intention, helps the person you're attending to, and it helps you.
Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, there's no doubt that you can do that. That's something you can measure.
I think HeartMath's done some work there where they've measured.
Yeah, they're
that.
Very interested in that work.
Now, let's talk a minute about you're saying that that we're one with everything. There's no distinction, and I happen to believe that too. But for the listening audience, why do you say that? From a physics perspective, why do you say that?
Well, I would say not from the physics experiment. Perspective, but from the work that we've done at SRI, I know that if I quiet my mind and simply visualize something so I can hold an object in my awareness, there's no real object, I'm just holding a mental picture in my mind. If you and I are well attuned and the conditions are right, you can begin to draw and describe exactly what I'm experiencing. So it's obvious that there is no separation between my mind and my experience and your mind and your experience.
What do you think is the cause for that?
For example, I tend to be a very thoughtful person. I don't normally blurt out the first thing that comes to my mind. So I can be sitting with my wife and figuring out how to say something. My wife will turn to me and say, "What did you say?" And, of course, I hadn't said anything, but I was just about to say something to her, and she's aware of that.
Do you think that there is a language problem here? But, you know, a lot of people think that it boils down to the atoms or the quarks or something, but those quarks and atoms have to lie on something. I mean, some intention has to come from somewhere to make the energy go through to make those things move. Do you think there's a kind of field or...
No, what I think is that we have a convenient idea that I'm holding a picture in my awareness and sending it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a convenient vocabulary. We talk about mental radio. But that's not really what's happening, in my opinion. I think that the Buddhists had it right, that there is no separation in consciousness, that separation is an illusion. I think the reason that somebody can sit in a laboratory in California and describe a nuclear reactor in Russia or a bomb test in China or a lost airplane in Africa is because there is no separation in consciousness between that person and the thing he's trying to describe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you mean by a non-local connection. Now, in physics, non-locality pertains to the idea that elementary particles, like photons or electrons, when they're born together in an experiment and travel off in opposite directions at the speed of light, they are still connected even though they're traveling away from one another at the speed of light. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Einstein described in 1935. And that was a very famous paper by him together with Podolsky and Rosen. And for 30 years, that was kind of called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, or EPR paradox. Mm-hmm. And Einstein said, the reason I know something's the matter with quantum mechanics is that quantum mechanics predicts this spooky connection at a distance between things that travel away from one another at the speed of light, mm-hmm. and that seems to violate special relativity that works very well. That was Einstein's view. In 1969, the experiment was done at the University of California, Berkeley, by Friedman and Clauser, two physicists, and they showed that even though the photons travel away from each other at the speed of light, they're still connected. Mm-hmm. And this connection has now been demonstrated over 50 miles by Nicholas Giessen in Switzerland. And it's a kind of, see, when the photons are born together, they're like identical twins. They're exactly the same spin and they're coherent with each other. And the greatest source of ESP that we see in the laboratory is between identical twins. When you have twins who are born together, of course, and reared apart, then they often have very profound ESP between each other.
What is it that's connecting them, Russell?
They're not...
Is it a wave? Is it a field? What is it?
What's connecting them is the idea that they're actually not separated. We live in a non-local space. And what that means is that we have a material, real, physical space-time where we live, where I'm in California and you're far away at the studio, so we have thousands of miles separating us in physical space, and you connect them with a railroad or a telephone wire. However, that space is really complex. That has a real part which has nuts and bolts and meat and potatoes, and a complex part which is off of the material plane and is filled with consciousness. And within consciousness, there is always a path. Now here's the interesting non-local idea. In a complex space-time such as we live in, there is always a path between two points that has no distance. You can always find a path in the complex space-time where the two things are together. So the reason...
I wish I could grasp that. I can't see it in my head. I battle with that because I don't have a physics background. So
well, you can just imagine that you have a ring of paper, and you could either go all the way around this paper or through the paper.
Mm-hmm.
We might be standing your feet on top and my feet on the bottom. And if we're standing foot to foot on opposite sides of the sheet of paper, there's really no space between us at all.
Mm-hmm.
We're standing feet to feet, I'm right side up and you're upside down, but we're exactly touching. But if you want to get to me, you'd have to go all the way to the edge of the paper and then all the way back on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Okay, that's a good description.
Okay. But in non-local space, that connection is direct. And the reason that we know it's non-local... And so
well,
this
for
is
my
not,
listeners, describe what you mean by local.
By local, it means that... all you have is a physical distance between things, and that defines what the distance is.
Okay.
Remote viewing is non-local, and that's not a metaphysical idea. By non-local, I mean that we have found, and many other people have found, that increasing the distance between the viewer and the target does not at all make it harder for him to give an accurate psychic description.
Mm-hmm.
The distance, the locality, the distance doesn't matter at all. That we've had as good descriptions of an atomic bomb test in China as we've had of the picture in the next room. increasing the distance 1,000-fold or 10,000-fold does not at all decrease the accuracy. Similarly, people can describe what we're going to show them or what will happen the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that. We were involved in a program to forecast changes in the silver commodity market a week in advance, and we did that 9 times in a row successfully. So we had 9 forecasts whether silver would go up or down, and each of those forecasts were correct. And we made $120,000. So again, this is not that we're not talking about metaphysics. This psychic ability is available, and we describe how to do that in The End of Suffering. We give a rundown on how to get in touch with the part of you that's psychic. Now, I should say the following year we were not successful in the silver market because our investor wanted to do it 2 times a week rather than 1 time a week, and that interfered with giving the subjects feedback as to how they did on the previous trial. So what did not work is rushing this so the viewer didn't get closure.
Interesting.
But,
how do you think that happens?
But a few years ago, I wrote another book called Miracles of Mind that talked about the silver forecasting. And my publisher said, if you guys are showing people how to do psychic things, I think that you ought to do it yourself. So my co-author, Jane Castro, is a spiritual teacher, spiritual healer. Jane and I did remote viewing in the silver market, and we were correct 11 out of 12 times. And we don't claim to be great psychics. We just made use of the remote viewing technology that we understand. And even mild-mannered authors can do this quite successfully.
Well, let me ask you.
And that's what we mean by non-local. By non-local, we mean that looking into greater and greater distances or looking further and further into the future does not make it any harder to be psychic.
Does it matter someone's, like, you don't know much about me, but I'm a medical intuitive. I had somewhat of a near-death experience, and when I woke up, I suddenly had this gift. Have you found that it matters someone's vocabulary? Are they limited to a certain field, like medical or money or financial, or can they do anything they want? Does that make sense?
Well, yes. The thing that I've just discovered is that intuitive diagnosis is actually easier than remote viewing, so I'm glad you asked me about that. I had a friend in my Course in Miracles group who said to me that I'm so experienced in remote viewing, she said to me, that I should learn to do intuitive diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never done anything like that that didn't greatly interest me as a physicist. But she said that I should really try that. She's been doing that for many years. And what I did to respond to your question, do you need a vocabulary? The answer is probably yes. And what I did is I purchased the 12 videotapes from the teaching company on anatomy and physiology so that I could educate myself as to what you say if you're looking into a person's body and see something. You really should be able to tell the difference between a spleen and a gallbladder.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you close your eyes and you look into somebody's body and it looks like a butcher shop.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, I see that there's something peculiar going on in among all those organs there. They're all twisted up. And that's not very helpful. So you should be able to recognize a pancreas or a liver or a spleen or a gallbladder or intestines. So you should really inform yourself of how to describe what you're looking at, or it's not going to make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some spiritual healers say your chakras are out of alignment. Your heart chakra is more orange than red. And by and large, people don't know what to do with that information.
Right.
You certainly can't take it to the doctor.
Right.
But if you say, I know you're feeling pretty good, but as I scan your body up and down, I see your pancreas has this really strange green stripe growing through it. All the other organs look nice and pink, but his pancreas looks like it has really something seriously the matter. I suggest you get your sugar checked.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, it's a good question you asked. You need a special vocabulary, and I think the answer is yes. You have to be, in my opinion, you have to be able to describe correctly what you're actually looking at, or it's not helpful.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you think that, let's talk about how this information is conveyed. Do you think information is encoded within frequencies, maybe with time, space, pulse, intervals, and voltage? Or
now, the frequency model, again, Upton Sinclair wrote a great book called Mental Radio, which I republished, actually, with a series of books that I republished. So Mental Radio was a wonderful book with a preface by Albert Einstein by Upton Sinclair showing that when he would draw pictures upstairs in his house, his wife, who was a great psychic downstairs, could reliably sense those pictures and draw them. So he wrote a whole book of his adventures in picture drawing with his wife in a situation where it's very well documented. And this is in the late 20s, and he called it Mental Radio because his picture was that he was beaming the signal from upstairs to his wife downstairs.
What?
Now, we're pretty confident that that's not the right answer,
mm-hmm.
because when you send things by radio, they get weaker as you get further and further away, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are absolutely confident of is that it's no harder for me to sit in California and describe what's going on in Russia than it is to describe what's happening in the next room. And the fact that increasing the distance, see, if you increase the distance 1,000-fold, that reduces the signal 1,000,000 times. And that's the way radio works. So that you would expect that if two people sit with their heads next to each other, I hold my friend's head right next to my head, and I visualize something, and she describes what I'm seeing. So in that case, there's 1 inch of distance between us. Now, she can get on an airplane, go to New York 3,000 miles away, and do that trick just as well. So you would expect the signal to be down by tens of millions of times,
mm-hmm.
and it's not. It's no harder to do at a distance than up close. So although in the 21st century we would like to say that this is a brainwave or some kind of mental radio, we think that's not really the right answer.
Well, now that you've mentioned the word brain, I want to ask you something. What is your definition of mind, and do you think that the mind thinks?
Well, the mind is certainly influenced by the brain. That is, if your brain goes dead, you're out of luck with regard to thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So the brain is obviously a big influence over the mind. So the mind, though, is a non-physical thing that has extension beyond the brain. The mind is really the analytical part of consciousness. In learning to do remote viewing, the analytical functioning of the mind is a lesser part of that. I tell people, let your mind go to sleep. I'm interested in your direct experience, uncharted, uncluttered by what you're thinking and your wonderful analytical ability. Give up the analysis now. I'm just interested in the pictures that come floating into awareness. And that's usually the right answer. And we've gotten very good. I'm going to be at the Omega Institute in the middle of September teaching people to do remote viewing. And the only reason I do that is that it's very much fun for me and for the other people because learning to do remote viewing is so easy. And one of the evidence that remote viewing is so easy to do is that if you go to the internet right now and look up remote viewing on Google. You put remote viewing in quotation marks, so you just get the pages pertaining to remote viewing. There's 1.5 million sites pertaining to remote viewing. And the reason that there's so many sites, I mean, that's a shocking big number of sites dealing with something that many people think doesn't exist.
Right.
A lot of interest in remote viewing, and that's because it's so easy to learn to do. And what happens is that everybody, I'm teaching remote viewing, and Paul Smith in Austin, Texas is teaching, and Skip Atwater at the Monroe Institute. So a lot of people connected with the Army program and the SRI program are teaching remote viewing because, like a party, it's very much fun to empower people. But as soon as somebody takes a class, one of my students comes to Omega with me in September and says, "That wasn't very hard. I'm able to see these pictures clearly. I can find my car keys. I can do all kinds of things." Then they want to go out and teach people to do remote viewing. So lots and lots of these sites on the Internet are people who want to teach you how to do remote viewing. And, of course, some are better than others, but by and large, remote viewing is so easy to do that I could teach you to do it on the phone.
That's amazing. Well, I have two questions I want to make sure that I ask, and I'm going to ask both of them. You can answer them however you want.
And, again, we want to, if people want to see what I'm up to or communicate with me, they should go to my website at espresearch.com, and I generally answer my email. That's the website showing my workshops, books, and so forth, and ESP pictures. All the data we've talked about here is up on my website, all the pictures of Russian things and island airports and so forth.
It's amazing what's on your website. I've seen it. It's a lot of information. That's one of the things that I wanted to know about. The two questions are, number one, what kind of response did you get from the peers out in the world? And number two, I wanted to ask you, what is the difference between mind and consciousness?
Well,
another two different questions that I
would... Well, people use consciousness and mind in different ways. Basically, what I would... And there is no hard and fast difference, in my opinion. Basically, I use mind for your analytical mind, where I say, okay, you've drawn a picture of something here now. That's a pretty good picture. Can you tell me what that reminds you of?
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I'm asking you to engage your analytical mind, which I normally tell you to please put to sleep, because memory and imagination and analysis is the enemy of psychic functioning. You don't want to do analysis when you're doing remote viewing, because it brings in memory, which is the opposite of the free-flowing experience that I want you to have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, consciousness is your awareness of all of space and time, and your awareness of who you are. Your awareness, the flow of loving awareness, is who you are. That when you quiet your mind and experience that loving presence and get in touch with your own divinity, that's really who you are. That's your expanded consciousness, which is available. Now, what was your first question?
The other one was, how did your peers react to this work you did in remote viewing? Because they tend not want to believe it, and I don't understand why, because the evidence is so glaringly predominant. But they still.
Well, my peers were very accepting. That is, we had a program for 23 years at Stanford Research Institute. We published our papers in Nature magazine, and the Proceedings of the Institute of Electrical Engineers, which are two of the most prestigious journals in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Engineering Society, the IEEE, Institute of Electrical Engineers, had two symposia on extrasensory perception that we conducted. And then we wrote a book comprising 12 papers from the Engineering Society, and that was called Mind at Large. That's another book that's in print. So if people want to see something technical from the Engineering Society, they could look at Mind at Large, which I've also just reprinted, and that's all papers from the IEEE.
And that's on your website?
Yes.
Okay.
Mind at Large. And then we had a conference supported by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS. We had a conference in 1979 called The Nature of Consciousness in the Physical World,
mm-hmm.
and that published some proceedings. And right now, we're having a conference supported by the AAAS at the University of San Diego, the 22nd of this month, on retrocausality. So it's a conference discussing how the future affects the past. How it is that you are able to have a dream tonight and see that fulfilled tomorrow. So it's basically a conference on precognition and retrocausality, again supported by the AAAS.
So I have
not suffered from my peers. For example, I was doing ESP research for a decade at Stanford, and then I did some freelance psychic functioning, looking for oil, and building toys for Atari, and forecasting silver futures.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing freelance psychic stuff for another 3 years, and then after 13 years of remote viewing work, I went immediately back to Lockheed as a senior scientist doing laser research.
That's interesting. So they
did not hold my ESP work against me at all.
That's not, you know, a lot of the people have problems like that. I know Bill Tiller's had problems. I know Claude Swanson's had problems. I had problems. I do medical malpractice litigation, and I've been a housewife for a long time, and when I went back to work, you know, now there's the internet too, they type my name in on the internet and see what I did, and it was hard for me to go back to work.
It may be easier for a physicist.
Interesting. One more question. We've got about 5 minutes. Do you believe that there's life after death?
I think the evidence for some kind of survival is really very good. I'm convinced by two kinds of evidence. F.W. Myers wrote a wonderful book, as you probably know. It's called Human Personality and the Survival of Bodily Death. And he talks about many cases where he visits mediums, and the medium can give him extremely detailed information about friends of his who have died.
Mm-hmm.
There's one case I remember where... Now, Myers was a very shrewd fellow, so he would send his servant with the name of a person in an envelope and says, "My master Myers wants to know about, can you give me any information about the person in this envelope?" Because he doesn't want the medium simply to read his mind.
Mm-hmm. That was going to be my question.
So in this case, the medium, who is Mrs. Verrill, who they... distinguished London medium at turn of the century, she said, "Oh, yes, he wants to remind you of the nice evening that you and he had in Paris. You're sitting on a terrace looking over the water. You had a wonderful dinner together. And he remembers that you really had a fancy for his walking stick with a blade hidden in the bottom of it that could be released. As a kind of a stiletto, we would say, or a sword cane." And the deceased guy said, "I don't need that anymore, of course. But if you go to my mother's house, that cane is leaning in the corner of the closet in the back, and I'm sure my mother will give it to you."
That's amazing.
And Myers did that, and he was given the cane. So that sounded to me a lot like a long-distance phone call from the dead. Sounded very, very convincing. So, there's a great deal of information like that in Myers' great book. And the other very recent case, published in the British SPR, Science Journal of the Society for Psychical Research, was of a chess game between a deceased Hungarian grandmaster, whose name I've forgotten because it's Hungarian, and the medium conjured up this dead Hungarian, and the Hungarian played a chess game through the medium against Victor,
really?
Against Victor Korchnoi, who is a living grandmaster. And the medium certainly does not play grandmaster quality chess, and this game went on for several years. By the middle of the game, Korchnoi was not sure he was going to win because the thing had become so complicated, which is the way this chess player liked to play. But in the end, Korchnoi did prevail. And we then sent all the moves to my brother-in-law, who's Bobby Fischer, the world chess champion in Iceland.
Uh-huh.
And his opinion was that anybody who can go 60 moves with Korchnoi is playing at grandmaster-level chess.
That's amazing. I had not heard of that. That's
so amazing. That's a very exciting contemporary case.
That's amazing, Russell. It's amazing. Well, if you have one thing that you can say to the world that you think would or could make a difference before we hung up, what would that be?
Well, I would certainly say that finding a way to quiet your chattering mind, to move into a meditative practice so that you can experience the spaciousness and the flow of loving awareness, which is who you are, that would be the way to start. You have to find a way to stop the chatter, and it's also very important to find a spiritual community where you can fearlessly participate in this kind of learning. Become part of a sangha or a spiritual community is critically important to do. And an investment club won't do it. It has to be a group of people with whom you can safely talk about these spiritual things as you get in touch with your spiritual nature. And I describe these elements in The End of Suffering, which is my brand new book on the subject.
And again, let's do one more time. Where can they find all of
this? They can find me at my website, which is espresearch.com.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tarr, for coming on my show. I hope you'll come back. I'm
very happy to talk with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Agape, my friend.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.